Few voices have echoed the trauma of colonialism and the power of cultural survival like Joseph Hill's. Born in Linstead in 1949, Hill rose from singing in a Jamaican church to leading culture, one of reggae's most prophetic bands. His landmark track, Two Sevens Clash, predicted an apocalyptic judgment upon Jamaica on July 7, 1977. On that day, the city shut down in stunned silence. Hill didn't just make music, he spoke truth. Through lyrics like those in Humble African and Forward to Africa, he reclaimed an ancestral voice that colonialism tried to silence. His deep, smooth baritone became a messenger for Rastafari ideals and African pride, a prayer and sharp critique at once. From the studios of Joe Gibbs to punk stages in London, Hill's songs spread a message of resistance, unity, and awakened identity. This story uncovers how one man's voice pierced through colonial legacies, challenging us to reckon with shared histories and cultural fractures. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, Roots, Prophecy and Foundations. Before the world knew Joseph Hill as the thunderous voice behind the band culture, he was just a boy in Linstead, Jamaica, growing up surrounded by cane fields, hymns, and hardship. Born on January 22, 1949, Hill's early life was shaped by a deep sense of spiritual duality. His first stage was the pulpit. His first audience was his family's church congregation. He sang hymns in the morning, then listened to Niyabingi drumming in the hills by night. These seemingly opposing forces, Christianity and Rastafari, would later fuse into the lyrical alchemy that made Hill one of reggae's most potent prophets. But it wasn't just music that formed him, it was resistance. Hill's grandfather, a Maroon descendant, told stories of rebellion against British rule. His mother warned him never to trust a system that kept its foot on the backs of black men. From childhood, Hill understood what many learned too late. Silence is complicity, and his life would be a defiant, melodic refusal to be silent. Sound systems and the rise of a voice. By the 1960s, Jamaica was transitioning from colonial rule to independence. The streets were alive with the energy of ska, the birth of rocksteady, and the echoes of pan-Africanist revival. Joseph Hill was caught in that current. He made his first mark not as a singer, but as a percussionist. In Studio One, Clement Coxon Dodd's legendary recording house, Hill worked as a studio hand and later performed as a member of the Soul Defenders band. It was here that he soaked up the mechanics of reggae, how rhythm could speak what language sometimes couldn't. He began laying down vocals too. Songs like Behold the Land and Take Me Girl hinted at the themes he would later shout from global stages. Land, belonging, stolen identity, and the hunger for self-definition. These weren't love songs. They were songs of memory, the kind that refused to let trauma fade into history books. Hill also became a DJ on sound systems like El Paso and Trelawney Hi-Fi. This wasn't just nightlife, it was political life. Jamaican sound systems were news stations, therapy sessions, and battlegrounds. They amplified the frustrations of ghetto youth and allowed messages of hope, fire, and awakening to soar over zinc-roofed tenements. Hill understood the microphone wasn't just for entertainment, it was for liberation. Enter Culture, a name with intent. In 1976, Hill officially formed the band Culture alongside Kenneth Days and Albert Ralph Walker. Originally known as the African Disciples, the group soon renamed themselves Culture, a bold, unapologetic signal. They weren't here to entertain, they were here to restore. While many Jamaican acts were shifting toward lovers rock or dancehall, Hill and his band leaned hard into militant roots reggae. They came to prophesy, to criticize, and to connect the diaspora's spiritual pain with its ancestral glory. Their first big opportunity came at Joe Gibbs' studio, the launchpad for legends. Hill walked in with a voice that shook the room and a message that jolted the consciousness. What came out of that studio wasn't just an album, it was a warning. 2-7's clash. Prophecy hits the charts. Joseph Hill had a vision, one so vivid and unsettling, he couldn't sleep. It came to him during a Kingston bus ride. He saw chaos, judgment, and upheaval striking the island on July 7, 1977, the day the D-7s would clash. To most, it might have seemed like numerology or mystical paranoia, but Hill believed it with every fiber of his being. He turned the vision into a song, then an entire album. 2-7's Clash was released in 1977, a year already charged with political unrest, gang warfare, and post-colonial disillusionment. Hill's voice thundered, "When the 2-7s clash, there'll be no peace." To the establishment, it was a disturbance. To the ghetto youth, it was scripture. On July 7, 1977, Hill's prophecy seemed to fulfill itself. Kingston streets emptied, businesses shut down, parents kept their children indoors. It was as if the island held its breath. Even those who mocked the message were unnerved by the eerie silence. The album became a cultural earthquake, blasting through speakers in Trenchtown and Brixton, embraced by punks in London, who found solidarity in Hill's anti-establishment defiance. The band was now international, but they didn't soften. If anything, Joseph Hill became bolder. Prophecy meets movement. By the late 70s, Hill's lyrics had expanded beyond apocalyptic visions. He delved deeper into black consciousness, ancestral longing, and post-colonial critique. Songs like Humble African, Natty Never Get Weary, and Zion Gate became anthems of dignity. Hill wore his African identity like armor. His lyrics weren't just poetic, they were pedagogical. He taught history, he demanded accountability, and he never let his audience forget where they came from. He also made enemies. Politicians accused him of inciting unrest. Radio stations censored his more militant songs. But Hill stood firm. He was no longer just a musician. He was a keeper of Zion Gate, a spiritual messenger tasked with reminding a broken people of their unbroken lineage, spiritual grounding and musical intelligence. Hill wasn't a man of formal education, but he had a scholar's mind and a sage's clarity. He devoured books on Marcus Garvey, Ethiopian history, and biblical prophecy. He read not to impress, but to arm himself with knowledge. In interviews, he spoke with the conviction of a man who knew who he was and who his enemies were. He believed reggae was a sacred gift, given to black people as a tool for resistance. And he saw commercial dilution of reggae as a form of neo-colonial sabotage. Hill insisted that music must serve the people's elevation, not their escape. "If my music don't open your third eye," he once said, "then I have failed." He never failed. Joseph Hill's rise wasn't luck. It wasn't fame chasing. It was prophecy in action, driven by an ancestral obligation to speak truth through rhythm. But the setup was only the beginning. As Hill's fame spread, so too did the danger, the opposition, and the weight of his message. What happens when your art becomes a weapon and the system starts aiming back? Chapter 2, Escalation, Lyrics as Resistance, and the Fire That Follows. Joseph Hill never expected comfort. He didn't enter music to be embraced by the system. He came to confront it. And by the time 2-7's clash ignited fear across Kingston and fascination across Europe, Hill understood the magnitude of what he had unleashed. His music was no longer just art. It was activism with a baseline, and not everyone wanted to hear it. When the lyrics cut too deep, Hill's songs were prophetic sermons, echoing through dusty sound systems and across crowded festival stages. In Humble African, he challenged Jamaicans who had abandoned their roots for European ideals. "Don't be ungrateful. Don't turn your back on Africa." In Forward to Africa, he offered no apology for his longing to return to ancestral soil. "Africa must be free by the year 1983. He was daring listeners to imagine a future outside the colonial framework, to envision liberation, not as theory, but as obligation. The powers that be weren't amused. Radio airplay dwindled. Politicians whispered. Religious leaders accused him of idolatry, but Hill didn't flinch. He doubled down. For Joseph Hill, every performance was a battlefield. Every lyric was a bullet of truth aimed at mental slavery. Cultures rise amid repression. As the 1980s dawned, Jamaica was drowning in political violence, economic instability, and rising drug culture. Reggae, once a vehicle of protest, was being commodified. But culture, still led by Hill's unshakable vision, refused to bend. Their albums during this period, such as Harder Than the Rest and International Serb, clung tightly to themes of spiritual integrity, communal resilience, and anti-colonial fire. Hill refused to dilute his message to please foreign markets. He wouldn't trade spiritual gravity for radio play. In Stop Fussing and Fighting, he called out the bloodshed consuming Kingston's ghettos, blaming both political parties and foreign influence. Too many youth gone under, while them leaders sip champagne. It was a direct accusation, and it sparked backlash. Culture's performances in Jamaica were often surveilled. Promoters were pressured not to book them. International tours kept them afloat. But even abroad, Hill's resistance was misunderstood. In London, some white fans embraced the Rastafari imagery, but missed the message. In the US, culture was lumped in with feel-good reggae, while Hill was warning of spiritual war. In Africa, however, he was seen as a returning son. Africa embraces its son. Hill had always looked toward Africa, not as a metaphor, but as home. His music was a call for diasporic return, not just physical, but emotional and psychological. When culture finally toured West Africa in the mid-1980s, it was more than a concert. It was a pilgrimage. In Nigeria, Ghana, and Côte d'Ivoire, Hill performed for crowds that understood his cry. Elders in Mali wept when he sang, "Why Worry About Them?" Students in Senegal chanted, "Down in Babylon," like scripture. For Hill, this was validation. His music wasn't abstract. It was ancestral retrieval. In Africa, he wasn't an entertainer. He was a messenger, a cultural bridge between fractured identities. And he never returned the same. He began dressing exclusively in African garb, bald kente, flowing white robes, leather sandals. His dreadlocks grew long and free. His speeches on stage became longer, more forceful, and in every country he visited, he asked one question that haunted him. Why do we remember the names of our slave masters, but not the names of our ancestors? That question became the backbone of his next wave of music, albums as testaments of survival. By the mid-1990s, culture had released more than a dozen albums. Some were studio polished, others raw and urgent. All were rooted in defiance. Albums like Baldhead Bridge, Nuff Crisis, Wings of a Dove, and Trust Me were chapters in a larger sermon. A sermon about dignity under duress. In Ja Pretty Face, Hill sang not just about love, but about divine reflection in blackness. In Riverside, he warned of spiritual decay in a society more obsessed with appearances than justice. His words cut across class, race, and generation. You can't hide from truth, no matter how fine your suit. Culture wasn't chasing hits. They were leaving behind blueprints. Each album was an instruction manual for the oppressed. How to survive colonization. How to speak truth in a world that profits from lies. How to raise children who know who they are. Hill believed music should educate, and when it didn't, it became part of the problem. Educator, not entertainer. Joseph Hill viewed every stage as a classroom. At concerts, he'd stop mid-song to explain lyrics. He'd name historical figures whitewashed from textbooks. Queen Nanny, Sam Sharp, Haile Selassie, Marcus Garvey. He'd ask audiences, "What do you know of Ethiopia before the Bible? What do you know of yourselves before slavery? He never performed to be liked. He performed to awaken. Entertainment is distraction, he once said. Culture is memory, and memory is power. In a world that wanted black memory erased, Hill became its archivist. But teaching came with a cost. Sponsors pulled support. Big festivals dropped culture in favor of lighter acts. Critics accuse Hill of being stuck in the past. But to Joseph Hill, the past was not past. It was bleeding out in every ghetto, still trapped by colonial economics and Eurocentric thinking. The fire that followed, the more culture sang of pride, the more the pressure mounted. Hill had threats made against him. His home was once broken into, and his lyric book stolen. Some never recovered. He was labeled a troublemaker, a militant, even too serious for reggae. But he never backed down. Even when his health began to decline in the early 2000s, he refused to cancel shows. Hill believed his life was not his own. It was the vessel for a message that must outlive him. And that message was clear. You are not what the system tells you. You are the dream your ancestors died for. Stand up. Remember. Resist. By the end of the 1990s, Joseph Hill had become something greater than a musician. He was a keeper of collective memory, an archivist of pain, pride, and prophecy. His voice was no longer just a sound. It was a weapon, a prayer, a teacher's cry in the wilderness. Chapter 3. Climax. The final performance, the prophetic death, and the legacy still speaking. On August 19, 2006, in the heart of Berlin, Germany, Joseph Hill collapsed just hours before he was scheduled to perform. He had been touring relentlessly, despite fatigue, despite the mounting toll on his body. For months, fans and friends noticed his gait had slowed, his voice a little raspier, his breath sometimes short after sets. But Hill would never cancel. Not for money, not for fame, but because to him, every performance was a sacred appointment, and missing one might mean failing his mission. That night, the message outlived the messenger. Joseph Hill passed away in a foreign land, far from Linstead, far from Zion, but never far from purpose. And his final journey would shake the reggae world to its core. Death of a messenger. The news broke like thunder across the Caribbean diaspora. Jamaican radio stations interrupted programming to announce it. Rastafari elders held drum circles in mourning. Across Africa, European cities, and U.S. reggae communities, fans gathered for vigils. Some couldn't believe it. Others called it prophecy fulfilled. After all, Hill had always warned that the life of a prophet comes with sacrifice. He died doing what he always did, delivering the word unrelentingly, and the world took notice. Prime Minister Portia Simpson Miller called his death a cultural loss of seismic proportions. Veteran reggae artists paid tribute. Church groups prayed for his soul. Rastafarian gatherings held Nyabingi services, beating drums for his ascension. But no one was more shaken than Hill's own family. His wife Pauline, who had managed Culture's tours, and their son Kenyatta Hill, who served as the band's sound engineer, now faced a choice. Let the voice die, or carry it forward. Kenyatta Hill, the inheritance of fire. In one of the most emotional transitions in reggae history, Kenyatta Hill stepped forward. A quiet technician, he had never sung publicly before. But on that tour, just days after his father's death, Kenyatta took the mic, in tears, with trembling hands. He sang Two Sevens Clash to a stunned crowd in Belgium, and the audience wept with him. What should have been the end became a rebirth. Kenyatta Hill would not impersonate his father. He brought his own sound, but the message remained intact. He carried on the mission with the same intensity. Touring as Culture with Kenyatta Hill, releasing albums like Live On, and speaking boldly on stage about his father's teachings. My father's voice was a bridge. I'm just walking across it. Over time, Kenyatta became not just an heir, but a guardian, honoring his father's memory while guiding new generations toward ancestral awareness. The institutional reverence Joseph Hill's physical body was laid to rest in Jamaica, but his legacy was immortalized through official honors. He was posthumously inducted into the Jamaican Reggae Walk of Fame. He received the Order of Distinction from the Jamaican government. Museums curated exhibits featuring his lyrics, robes, and handwritten notes. Scholars analyzed his work in academic papers on post-colonial resistance and Afro-Caribbean identity. Schools began using his lyrics as teaching tools. Activists quoted his words at protests. And perhaps most powerfully, young reggae artists began shifting back toward roots consciousness. Hill's work had planted seeds. Now they were growing. Echoes across time. Joseph Hill's catalog spans over 20 studio albums, dozens of international compilations, and untold hours of live recordings. But more than quantity, it's the quality of conviction that makes his music eternal. His songs weren't trend-driven. He never rode waves. He built foundations. Today, when Ja Rastafari, a humble African, plays on speakers in a Brooklyn record store, or in a Nairobi street vendor's stall, or from a teenager's headphones in Kingston, it is not nostalgia, it is activation. Hill's lyrics are still urgent. Tell me, where is your pride, Africa child? No night can be too dark for Ja light to shine. Down in Babylon, where they try to chain your mind, these aren't lyrics, they are instructions for spiritual warfare. His final lesson, memory is resistance. Hill believed history was a living force, not a textbook. Colonialism didn't end with flags changing. It hid in boardrooms, fashion trends, language, and religion. He saw cultural amnesia as the greatest threat to Black identity, and he spent his life interrupting that, forgetting. Even his quiet moments were intentional. He refused to trim his locks. He refused to wear suits. He declined major label deals that would compromise his message. To Hill, success without sovereignty was another form of bondage. You cannot be free until your mind is, he told a journalist. And music is the key that opens that lock. He never saw himself as a legend. He saw himself as a messenger. And messengers don't need to be worshipped. They need to be understood. What culture really meant. Joseph Hill named his band Culture not to reflect Jamaican fashion or music style, but to remind us who we are. He reclaimed a word that colonial powers had used to judge, categorize, and erase. To him, culture was not an accessory. It was survival. It was maroon chants in the Blue Mountains. It was mother tongues whispered in cane fields. It was dreadlocks, Ital food, the Lion of Judah, and the refusal to bow. And in every song, he passed down that inheritance. Culture was not a band. It was a movement in sound, one that still roars in his absence. Joseph Hill did not die in Berlin. He lives in every Black child who questions the version of history they were taught. He breathes in every lyric that refuses to conform. He stands in every act of remembering, resisting, and rebuilding. He was not here to entertain you. He was here to awaken you. So ask yourself, are you awake yet? Or are you still sleeping through the revolution that sings in your blood?